Welcome to Now You Know. I'm Catherine Sussman. Today, my guest is People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals president and founder herself, Ingrid Newkirk. Revered by some, condemned by others, one thing is certain. Ingrid has changed the world on a global scale for the better by exposing animal cruelty and the devastating effects of speciesism like no other. Ingrid is the subject of the HBO documentary, I Am an Animal, and has written 8 books about helping animals. Her latest, Animal Kind, co-authored with Jean Stone, is now available online and in bookstores and is a fascinating read. Thanks for listening. Ingrid, it is truly a privilege to be able to speak with you and learn from you today. Congratulations on the recent release of your latest book, Animal Kind, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm quite excited to have this book out at last.
Since February is Fashion Month around the world, on our podcast, Now You Know, we're devoting the month to the issue of animal products and clothing. 2 weeks ago, we aired a podcast featuring fashion designer Joshua Katcher on why veganism needs to be about more than just diet and how factory-farmed animal cruelty extends beyond animals used for the food industry. The first thing I'd like to ask you about is that while veganism as a diet has really entered the mainstream in recent years, veganism as a lifestyle inclusive of avoiding animal products in clothing, cosmetics, and other household items still seems to have a long way to go. And I'm just wondering your feelings on this.
Well, I think things sort of speed up exponentially once people get a clue as to what they're really contributing to. We've seen that with vegan food, vegan eating, the idea of a vegan diet. So it was sort of rejected initially, and then people discussed it, and then people learned, oh, it's better for the planet, it's better for health. Oh, good Lord, do they do those things to animals? And so there was a shift, and then the marketplace took it over, and suddenly, you know, you really can't move without falling over a vegan food. So it's fantastic. You know, when we started, you had soy milk that came in a powder and you mixed it by hand, or if you were lucky enough to have a whisk. But now you go to the store and you've got almond macadamia, soy, coconut. I mean,
everything.
This is what happens. So it just goes zoom. I do believe with all my heart that that is what is going to happen with vegan materials, both in fashion, in practical clothing, in car interiors, the works.
Do you see this shift occurring already and you're pleased with the movement of this?
Very much so. But one point I would like to make is that if you have an ethical objection to slaughtering animals for food, it's worth remembering that I don't even think there's an exception, not even one, to the fact that all the animals who are tormented and tortured and slaughtered for materials actually end up being eaten. And that's true even of exotic animals, if you call them that, like little crocodile fillets now that they can, ostrich for the feathers. There are ostrich burgers, for goodness sake. But sheep, goats, cows, leather is an enormous part of the profits that comes from slaughtering a cow. If you look at a place called anywhere in Asia, but look at India, which exports mass quantities of leather, something that actually shocks people because people think, oh, aren't cows sacred in India? Yes, but they go to slaughter, believe it or not, in most of India. But if you look at those cows, that cattle, the buffaloes, the bulls, the cows, their skin and bones, the amount of flesh food that you get off them is minimal compared to the amount of hide you can sell. So when you look at a leather bag or a couch or something in this country, and if you really examine it, you can actually see marks on it. Those aren't from processing. Those are from the cow's life of banging against a fence or being hit on the truck or whipped along while he's pulling the cart. And all that leather is the profit that's going into the slaughtering industry. So you really, if you care about it from a food ethical perspective, you cannot wear these animals' hide, their wool, their flesh, their fur, their feathers on you, because you'll be contributing to slaughter.
Can you give us a sense of the scale of the animals used, abused, and killed for skins and fur? And the other question is, for those of us who it's so hidden from in the urban centers, what are these animals' lives really like?
Well, it's extraordinary. The numbers are astronomical because almost every animal has every bit squeezed out of them for profit. So it's not as if what used to be called nothing goes to waste. What I would say is, you know, nothing gets thrown out. Everything is sold. So the enterprise is enormous. We're looking at every single kind of animal you can imagine, almost. Certainly any animal who comes to the table in bits, or you could see in the supermarket case or on a restaurant menu. And it's worldwide. So we have the animals you do realize are being made into leather jackets and leather shoes, the cows and the pigs and so on. But you have animals like rabbit. I think it was 2.5 years ago or so, we went to China. It might be a little longer. And we found horrific Chinese angora farms, because most angora originates in China. And of course, there are many, many horrors that are coming out of China. There's almost no animal consciousness there at all. But on these farms, the rabbits are kept in tiny wire mesh cages, just individually, and then they are live plucked for their fur. It's just heart-rending. So every single one of those who ends up being eaten anyway is tortured over and over again, as long as their hair grows back, for a period of perhaps 3 years or so, if they don't die in their cages, which many of them do, because there's no veterinary care. They do get diseases. And I mean, they're just so incredibly depressed and traumatized and scared of everything. We've got ostriches. We just did an undercover investigation of mohair. We did one of cashmere, a live combing of the goats while they're strapped down and screaming. I mean, I don't wish to make this into a horror fest, but it is a horror fest. And so every kind of animal all over the world, anybody who ends up on a plate, yes, they may go through a battery of absolute physical assaults for their life until the moment that they're shoved on the truck or have their necks wrung.
I just actually returned from a holiday in England because my partner's English, and we started discussing sheep. You, being a Brit, obviously know this, but as you drive around the English countryside, there's these fields of idyllic sheep. And then when you start having a discussion about factory farming and sheep, it's really, really interesting, because I think as a Canadian from an urban center, taking a trip to England like that, it can reinforce the idea, well, oh, is this such a bad thing? Why would shearing, you know, sheep that are living in this kind of a condition, why is that so terrible? Can you address that for us and how the majority of animals in factory farm conditions are not living anything close to a life like that?
Well, even a life like that, I am so glad you brought it up. I was on a train going from England to Scotland. It was winter. We were looking out of the window and there were all these, you know, adorable, beautiful, peaceful sheep on the hillsides. And everyone was sort of going, ooh, ah, as we do. I started to talk to people in the carriage because, of course, we have done so many undercover investigations inside the shearing sheds. And I mentioned to them, you know, those sheep are out there in all weather. My father grew up next to a sheep farm in England, and he said every winter they had pneumonia. The sheep would be hacking and coughing because the farmers wait until the very last moment to shear them before the winter comes so they can get maximum wool. But anyway, these sheep are exposed to all the elements. Their coats get absolutely sodden with snow, with sleet, with rain. They often give birth, they lamb, out in snowdrifts on these lovely looking idyllic farms and the hills. They're lucky if the lamb lives, they live, and if they don't, they don't. They're by themselves, you know, out there lambing. They have their coats taken off because many of them are bred to have extra wool that they don't want to carry, that allows flies to lay their eggs inside it, which makes maggots appear. Some of them die of fly strike from the maggots, especially in Australia, where we've done many investigations, and which is, of course, the sheep farming capital of the world. And when you go into the shearing sheds, and we have done that, I think we have, I may tell you the wrong figure, I think it's 17 investigations, might be 19 now, it's on every continent except Antarctica, you see the men have to move very quickly and they need to speed up because they're paid by how quickly they can do their job, not by the care they take. When you're moving so quickly and you've got an electric pair of shears and you're just barreling through, a teat will come off, the edge of an ear will come off. You will cut the side of an animal, especially around the knee or under the tail.
It's really startling to hear you describe this because out of all of the practices that go on with factory farming, you would think that shearing would be the least, you know, harmful. In your book, you talk about Chris, the sheep who got separated from his flock and had 89 pounds of wool that had to be sheared off of him. Could you describe that a little bit?
Well, what happens in Australia, what they've done is they've imported sheep from Spain, merinos. And you know, if you go to the store, you look at cardigans or something, jumper sweaters on the rack, and you see a label that says, all merino wool, as if this is something grand. All merinos are sheep that live in the mountains of Spain, and they have very thick, curly wool. It's not suited to the drought conditions, the heat of Australia. And what the Australians have done, the farmers years ago, back in the early 1900s, 1900 actually, moved Spanish merino sheep over to Australia and actually have sheep now who have far more wool than a sheep might normally have. And this is one of the reasons they get fly strike, is because all those extra folds of wool that build up and up and up are ideal nesting places for flies to go and lay their eggs, which, as I say, you know, becomes a maggoty infestation. And you can sometimes just pull the whole coat off the sheep, just peel it back. But because they're merinos, they just keep growing this very thick, bushy wool that isn't natural for them in Australia. And this sheep who got away just kept growing it, and he managed. But when he was shorn, it weighed all that many pounds.
Can you explain a bit about PETA's skins campaigns and the kind of the method to the madness in terms of PETA's choice to be deliberately provocative in order to get its messages across? In other words, why do you feel it's necessary to be radical in order to be heard these days?
Well, being radical is only one part of what we do. And that's the part the press loves. That's the part that gets in the news. And that's by design. Because you have to put a social issue into the news for people to know it exists and people to discuss it. I mean, if we were quiet back in the day when nobody cared about eating animals or drinking milk or any of those things, I don't believe we ever would have progressed to where we are today. We had to shake it up and make people see and so on. So today, for example, one of our provocative demonstrations, I suppose you'd call it that, is we have some of our people go out and they sit outside a fashion show or a shop that's selling a lot of leather, and they will pour black, it's muck, it's really a mixture of syrup and carbon, over their heads, and it just drips down their faces and their bodies. It's very photogenic. And everybody has to look, everyone has to take a picture. That picture appears in the press, and it says, you know, leather
forces us to confront, doesn't it?
Yeah, leather is an environmental disaster. Now, who walking down the street has thought of leather as an environmental disaster? That conversation has to start. Mm-hmm. But the other thing you don't hear about, of course, because it's boring, is we're in corporate boardrooms, we're retailers, we're talking to purchasers, we're dealing with people who are producing new materials, which is so exciting, and we're linking them up to retailers. And we are talking to kids about why it's a kind choice to make to step away from leather and wool and so on. So all the other stuff you won't read about in the press, just the provocative stuff.
But I have been, in preparation for interviewing you, I have been reading, and it is nothing short of incredible, everything that you have accomplished since founding PETA, unbelievable things such as getting a stop to the use of animals in crash tests in the car industry and obtaining the first felony charges of cruelty to animals involving factory farms. Just really, truly admirable and remarkable.
Thank you. When you mention the fact that we did stop animals being smashed into walls in car crash tests. And when you see a car crash dummy on television, it's because we did that. Otherwise, they were taking pigs and baboons. They had a device in all these car company factories in their research labs, and they would smash them into a wall. And so we did stop that. But what it took was, while we had begged to meet with them, we had scientists to talk to them about computer technology and mannequins and robots and so on, they weren't interested. They were just doing business as usual. And what it took in the end is an escalation, a photogenic escalation, but a scary one, of our members gave us their old cars. And we got to the point where we were setting fire to those cars outside auto showrooms, and in order to get a meeting with the people, the corporate executives in the major car companies like GM. And it worked in the end, but that's what it took. I mean, it shouldn't have, but it did, and we were willing to do it.
I feel like we need another revolution now in terms of leather used in especially the higher end car companies.
I have great news on that.
Good.
People are shocked to know it can take up to 8 cows to do a single leather interior, because everything has to be just so. We've been working on this, and first the Nissan Leaf came out with an all-vegan car. And then, of course, there have been Jaguar in the UK made a vegan option. So you could get leather from cows, or you could get cloth, or you could get a synthetic. Then this year, just in the last maybe 6 months or so, we have seen that breakthrough. We've been going to the Tesla stockholder meetings and talking to the man. First, there was some reluctance. Then it was, okay, we'll have a vegan option for Tesla. And we said, that's not good enough. It's Tesla. Environmentally conscious of nothing
else. Exactly.
So now we've got all vegan Teslas, they're just on the market. But it's not just the high-end. It is the high-end cars too, but it's not just the high-end cars.
I haven't had to look for a car in a few years, but the last time I tried, it was definitely, there were very limited options. So that's great to hear about.
You do have to push. You're absolutely right. I mean, you do have to show that there is consumer demand. And I say to people, please go to the website. If you've got a particular car that you think you're one day going to replace with another particular car, make sure that the manufacturers know now that you're looking for a vegan car. A friend of mine got a Volvo 2 years ago, and they said, oh, they didn't think so, or you'd have to go to Sweden. And he said, really want a Volvo? And they said, okay. And so he got a vegan Volvo. And it wasn't any extra. It's just that they had to think about it.
Well, that's great that they're listening to consumers' demands. Getting back to your book, in Animalkind, you highlight the intelligence and sentience and complexity of various animals. And I was just wondering, can you tell us a bit about those aspects of animals that are used specifically for skins and fur and wool? So animals such as cows, sheep, geese.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, geese, we underestimate who animals are. We're just one among a series of animals. All of us, every species is intelligent, communicates in its own way, has thoughts, desires, doesn't want to die, you know, wants to live free. Animals are wonderful mothers. Geese, you mentioned, they mate for life. They're devoted partners. They could teach human beings a lesson or two on how to be loyal. Even if a goose is shot, that goose's mate will come down to the ground and sit with that goose, that other goose, at great risk. I mean, enormous risk to their own lives. They're just so devoted. If you read about sheep, they're quite extraordinary. People dismiss them as just going along with the crowd. But sheep go along with the crowd for a reason, is they all stick together and they watch, and they have very intelligent rams, if they're allowed to, who look out for them. And sheep, when they're in experiments, which is so, so sad, if you put a sheep, and they have, in a room, and you're about to do an experiment on them, you know, a procedure is about to happen. If you put a photograph of another sheep on the wall, a photograph, it helps calm that sheep somewhat.
Isn't that extraordinary? Wow.
It's amazing. Sheep can recognize over 20 other human beings and other sheep from photographs. They're able to know that's you. So there's so many things about sheep, so many things about cows. how they jump for joy when they figure things out, like the latch on a gate they've been trying to get out of, or how to operate a water pump with their horns, which they do in Asia all the time. They watch, they learn, and they are thirsty, and they go over there, and they use their horns, because they don't have opposable thumbs, obviously, the way luxury we have, and they pump the water out. They're just all extraordinary in so many ways. It's just we're not looking. Even with our dogs at home, it's always, you know, sit, stay, come, fetch the ball back to me, hurry along on your walk, you know, eat your food when I say don't beg.
We completely underestimate them.
Yeah, they're whole, they're complete, they're thinking, they're feeling, they're emotional beings. They're not accoutrements to our life. They're not just shoes and burgers that we haven't killed yet. They're other individuals, other tribes, other people like us.
One thing I really love about your book, this recent one, Animal Kind, is that you really point out the prejudice of this speciesism, really, and that it doesn't make sense to value animals based on how they are the most intelligent according to whatever set of factors it is that humans use to determine that. And I think that's just a really important thing for people to think about.
Yes, absolutely. We are, Peter, determined to put forward this argument against speciesism, which is simply discrimination based on the arbitrary factor that that's a different species than mine. And this is the same thing with racism, sexism, ageism. You're not quite like me, so not so sure I care about you that much. And in fact, I might be afraid of you, or I might wish to deny you basic things. So if we are opposed in principle to discriminating on an individual or a group of individuals on the basis of what they look like, whether their culture is like ours, whether we can understand their language, whether they come from another place, then we know that's all rubbish. So it's just as much rubbish to look down our noses at others who happen to have longer noses or shorter noses or longer ears or who walk on four legs instead of two.
So for those listeners who really do want to start incorporating veganism into like a full lifestyle beyond diet, what actions, what I love about this book as well is that you do have a section at the end of every chapter with what people can do. So specifically when it comes to fashion, what are some of the suggestions you have? I know here in Canada, one thing that is tricky is to find vegan shoes. So I have this dilemma a lot. I look around and I'll find what I think is a vegan pair of shoes, but then the glue used in the shoe isn't vegan and it can be a challenge. So do you have some advice for those of us that are trying to find vegan options? What do you recommend?
I recommend going online, and it may be impossible to find something that's 100% pure in some cases, but you can certainly find if you look. And I'm a little bit Imelda Marcos on shoes. I do love them. And I have found fabulous shoes of all places in France, which is not known to be vegan friendly. But I find that cheaper shoes are often vegan. And I get quite excited because I always look at shoes in shop windows and shops and think, oh, look, those are vegan. So I think if you look and if you go online, you'll find them. But the most important thing is to do what we did with food and what we're doing with other things, is to make your consumer desires known to the companies. They really do tally up their consumer comments. They want to know what their customers want because they want to sell you something. And they want to know what isn't selling. Why isn't it selling? So I would say, please don't compromise and buy something that is easy to buy. Mm-hmm. Just look around, but go online and put your comments right to the company if you wish. Talk to sales managers so that they know the buzz, but really go to the tops of the companies and fill out those consumer surveys. Call the 1-800 or whatever they are numbers, the free numbers to call in, and ask that your complaint be registered. Why can't I find vegan shoes at your store? We do find that even big designers now, if you have the money and want to spend it this way, there's of course always still in the cart and people right. Like that who have vegan shoes. But yeah, you can find them, you just have to look. And that's true of all fashion and all clothing, is that we wouldn't have these wonderful fiber fill jackets now that replace something as ugly as Canada Goose, something that's filled with the feathers of slaughtered animals. I mean, we wouldn't have that if people hadn't spoken up and said, I'll buy one if you have one for sale.
So as an extension of that, do you feel then that it's okay to shop at places that also sell leather and wool, for example, as long as you don't buy those products and pressure those shops to include vegan options?
I very much do. I know the people are divided on this, but I'm in the camp that says, you know, if one of the fast food outlets that still sells flesh foods also offers a vegan burger, go and eat it, because that shows them that it's something people will buy. And what it does, and this is true in clothing or anything else, is it puts that item out, not for a small group of people in a vegan restaurant or a vegan clothing store, which God bless them all, may they thrive, but it puts it out to the masses who otherwise might not even think of having that vegan burger. And you see what's happening with Beyond Meat and KFC with the fried chicken. I mean, it's phenomenal. Working class people are coming off their truck and going into the door, and they see right on the menu in front of them that there's a vegan chicken or there's a Beyond burger or Beyond sausage. And it's not something they would have thought. They're not going. A lot of people are living on the poverty line. They're not looking at, you know, fancy pants restaurants. They're not choosing a vegan restaurant. They may never have eaten or bought something that's vegan knowingly. So I am a great supporter of supporting the big companies who are also at the moment selling things that we don't want them to sell.
And so much of those changes, though, are directly because of you, your organization, your work. Ingrid, thank you so much for everything you've done throughout your life to help the lives of countless animals all over the globe by speaking out and exposing cruelty and taking action. And also, thank you for helping us as humans to confront the fact that we are actually also animals and we need to respect the lives of everyone on the planet. It's really been such a pleasure and an honor to have you on today. I have tremendous respect for you. So thank you very much.
Oh, my. Oh, well, so it was nice. Lovely. Thank you, thank you, thank you for everything you do. That's terrific.
Thank you so much. Well, enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you very much.